Verses 1 to 11. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. And he will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And the little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put its hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. In that day, the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the surviving remnant of his people from Assyria, from Lower Egypt, from Upper Egypt, from Cush, from Elam, from Babylonia, from Hamath, and from the islands of the Mediterranean. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, this morning we're beginning a new series for Advent. Historically, Christians have spent the Advent season reflecting on four themes, or four virtues, that connect deeply with the Incarnation. The Incarnation is the idea that God himself put on human flesh and moved into our neighborhood in the person of Jesus. And those four themes are hope, peace, joy, and love. So over the next three Sundays, plus Christmas Eve, we're going to reflect on not just the fact of the Incarnation, but the meaning of the Incarnation, the purpose of the Incarnation, the implications of the Incarnation for our lives. And today we're going to talk about hope. And Isaiah 11 is one of those quintessential passages about hope. Isaiah wrote these words not long after Israel's northern kingdom fell, at the precise moment when the people were utterly hopeless. They were kingless, landless, powerless. When the odds of their even having a future at all were virtually nil. And Isaiah's prophecy begins, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. Now, Jesse was King David's father. Israel's destruction meant that David's family tree had been cut down. It had become a stump. But Isaiah says, hey, Israel may appear dead, but there's still life in the roots. And someday a fresh shoot is going to grow out of that dead stump. It's like in The Lord of the Rings when the white tree of Minas Tirith, which appeared dead, suddenly begins to bloom again at the return of the king. Then Isaiah starts to describe this shoot from Jesse's stump, this future king, the spirit of the Lord. Help if I turn this on, probably. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and of understanding. The spirit of counsel and of might. The spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what his eyes see, or decide by what he hears with his ears. He will be wise, faithful, discerning. Not one who's easily deceived by appearances. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor. Finally, finally, there will be someone on the throne who sticks up for the little guy, who defends those who can't defend themselves. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. Not only will he protect the poor and the weak, he will stand up against those who oppress and prey on the vulnerable, and he'll bring justice to the earth. Verse 5, righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. Who doesn't want a king like this? He checks off all the right boxes, doesn't he? And then in verse 6, we get a picture of what happens under this king's rule. The wolf will lie with a lamb. The leopard will lie down with a goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with a bear. Their young will lie down together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den. And the young child will put its hand in the viper's nest. This does not sound anything at all like the world in which we live. But when this king comes to power, creation will be healed. Enmity will be destroyed. Violence will be no more. The meek will finally inherit the earth. And then verse 9. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. This is deep cosmic healing. It's good news, not just for Israel, but for every nation. Now, there's something very strange in verse 10. You may have noticed it. Back in verse 1, Isaiah said, a shoot will come out of Jesse's stump. So new life out of the old. So clearly, he's talking about somebody who comes after Jesse, right? After David. But then in verse 10, without warning, he says that this future king will actually be the root of Jesse, which can only mean he comes before Jesse. How can the same person be both the root and the shoot of someone else? How can a king both proceed from and precede the same person? This must have just confounded everyone in Isaiah's day. We can only really understand how this works in light of the New Testament. The Apostle John reveals that this child, Jesus, who was born a king, was in fact the Word at the beginning. He is the Logos, the wisdom of God, the deep logic that holds the entire universe together. Jesus is both the root and the shoot of Jesse. He created Jesse and he comes after Jesse. Wild stuff. Even wilder in the 8th century BC. Back then, this prophecy was laughable. It was a pipe dream. Israel was dead. I mean, just look at history. Nations do not typically survive burning, destruction, and mass deportation. It was tremendously long odds that Israel would survive at all. Never mind that a carpenter from within their ranks, their oppressed ranks, would eventually subvert the empire and turn the whole world upside down. All without ever writing a book or commanding an army or killing a single soul. And this after he was executed in his early 30s. Who would have thought? And what I want us to see is that Isaiah didn't look around at the wasteland that Israel had become and calculate the odds of Israel making a comeback. He just said, hey, here's what God says he's going to do. Period. This morning, I want to talk about the ground of hope, the power of hope, and the impact of hope. First, the ground of hope. And let me give you the big idea right up front. Came from that video we just watched. Christian hope is not optimism based on the odds. Christian hope is confidence in a person. We trust God because God has a track record of being faithful. He has a track record of keeping his promises and doing what he said he was going to do. So for ancient Israel, the ground of their hope was the Exodus. Okay, we were slaves. We had nothing going for us. We were in a hopeless place, and God rescued us. He made a way where there was no way. And if God can do that, he can do anything. The God who led us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm can easily resurrect a dead line of kings, can easily put Israel back on the map, can easily work within this defeated people to bring about a king who will rule the world with justice and righteousness. Biblical hope is not optimism based on the odds. It is confidence in a person. The author of Hebrews in the New Testament says, "Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess." Why? "For he who promised is faithful." It all comes back to who God is. Optimism says, "Hey, you never know, maybe things will work out." We all have a friend like that. They're really annoying. Hope says, "I don't have a clue how any of this is going to work out, but I trust God." Apologies in advance for the football illustration. If you're visiting here today, this is probably my second football illustration in 9.5 years, so bear with me. But for 20 years, New England had Tom Brady. Do you know how many times Tom Brady led his team to a come-from-behind victory? 251 times. After a while, the Patriots were trailing. It didn't even faze me. I became so insufferably cocky as a Patriots fan during Tom Brady's career. Fourth quarter, down 10. It was never a question of, will he lead them back? It was always, how's he going to do it this time? But you knew he would. I got so cocky that even when the Pats were trailing the Falcons 28-3 in the third quarter of the Super Bowl, I stood up in my brother's apartment in Boston and I did my best Aragorn impersonation. "Patriots, my brothers, a day will come when the genius of our coach fails, when higher salary caps and stiffer equipment penalties make dynasties impossible. But it is not this day. An hour of Seahawks and Falcons, when the age of New England comes crashing down. But it is not this day. Today we fight." Yes, and I even made a meme to commemorate the occasion. And you know what happened? The Patriots scored 31 unanswered points, and Tom Brady threw for 466 yards, and I never doubted it for a minute. But after a while, a track record inspires confidence, even against overwhelming odds. Did you see that? I think at one point, the Falcons' chances of winning was 99.6%. Overwhelming odds. Christian hope is not optimism based on the odds. Christian hope is the choice to wait for God to bring about a future that is as surprising as a crucified man rising from the dead. That's as unlikely as the Savior of the world being born to an oppressed couple in a cave. Hope is a choice. It's the choice to trust God more than you trust what your eyes can see. Israel was right to carry that hope for 700 years. The logic was sound. If God can rescue us from slavery in Egypt, he can do anything. And the church, we should have a similar logic. If God can raise Jesus from the dead, he can do anything. If God can take the greatest tragedy, the greatest miscarriage of justice in the history of the world, and turn it into the greatest act of redemption in the history of the world, he can do anything. One of the drumbeats of the Christian scriptures is that Jesus' resurrection is just the beginning. It's just the first fruits of the new creation. And one day Jesus will make all things new, which is exactly what Isaiah is pointing to in the prophecy we read today. The ground of our hope is confidence in a person, and our confidence comes from what he's done in the past. God keeps his promises. Tom Brady, amazing quarterback, just a passing shadow compared to Jesus. Just a faint whisper of the one who inspires confidence against all odds. So that's the ground of our hope. What about the power of hope? Hope is trusting what God says about the future. The result of trusting what God says about the future is that we find ourselves energized in the present. I love this quote from Eugene Peterson. He says, "Hope is not about the future. Hope is about the present. It obviously has to do with the future, but it's a virtue which is cultivated in the present. It fills the present with energy. It connects the two comings of Jesus so that we now participate in them. We're not just remembering the one and believing in the other. We are participating in the continuity of the comings." Friends, this is what Advent is all about. Advent is a time to cultivate a deep confidence in Jesus and to let his resurrection in the past and the promise of total resurrection in the future to invade our present and energize and sustain us, especially when life gets hard. And this is why Peter calls Christian hope a living hope. It's a hope that invigorates us, that energizes us and mobilizes us. Isaiah 40, 31 says, "Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." Hope strengthens us to keep going. In the Apostle Paul's great chapter about the resurrection, he includes by saying to the church, "Stand firm, let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Because you know that Jesus, that life, that love will have the last word." Hope isn't optimism, it's confidence in Jesus' ultimate victory over sin, death, and the devil. And that confidence fills the present with energy. You can see hope at play, at work, all throughout the life of Jesus. Jesus had hope. Jesus was confident in his Father. He knew that part of his calling was to suffer, to be rejected and betrayed, tortured, crucified. He knew these things were coming, and yet he trusted that God would redeem it all and even raise his dead body. And as a result of that confidence, he was able to press on, to keep going, to keep loving his enemies, to forgive those who abandoned him, to forgive those who crucified him. He didn't look for a way out. He didn't look for a shortcut to glory. He pressed on and he fulfilled his calling. Isaiah says in chapter 53, out of that terrible travail of soul, talking about Jesus, he will see that it's worth it and be glad he did it. Because he looked death in the face and didn't flinch. Because he embraced the company of the lowest, he took on his own shoulders the sin of the many. He took up the cause of all the black sheep. Because Jesus trusted his Father, even in the face of suffering, he was able to endure it so that he could save us. And sometimes God calls us to do things that don't make a whole lot of sense. We have to give up control. Parts of us have to die. Sometimes Jesus leads us to get close to pain, our own or someone else's. Sometimes our faith costs us relationships or opportunities that we cherish. And when that happens, hope, confidence in who Jesus is what enables us to say, "Look, even if I can't see how this fits into the bigger picture, I am confident that God will work it out. So I'm going to keep trusting and obeying Jesus no matter what it costs me, because I know that he's good, and I know that in the end he will work all things for my good. And the world is a better place because people like Harriet Tubman, William Wilberforce, Florence Nightingale, Martin Luther King Jr., and a whole bunch of other people throughout history said, "I don't care what it costs me to do what God calls me to do. I'm going to choose hope. I'm going to trust that Jesus is working out his will no matter what happens to me." Jesus' hope transformed his approach to people. Jesus never wrote anyone off. He didn't think anyone was a lost cause. He believed that anyone could change. He believed that everyone is redeemable. And Jesus was routinely criticized for hanging out with the wrong people. And he didn't care. He figured if there's even a chance that this person will come to know God and be transformed by his grace, then I will gladly take the hit to my reputation to befriend them. Part of what's wrong with the world is that too many people have given up on too many people. Too many people think that too many people are irredeemable, or worse, monsters. Jesus never gave up on people. He held out hope that anyone could change. Hope can motivate us to move towards the very people that we're taught to fear and avoid, because God can transform anyone. Heck, if Saul, the terrorist, can become Paul, the missionary, then anyone can change. No one is beyond the reach of God's grace. No one is a lost cause. No one is irredeemable. Hope isn't a feeling, it's a choice. It's a choice to see people, not from a worldly point of view, but in light of who they could become with Jesus. Hope, confidence in God's grace can turn you into the kind of person who doesn't demonize or give up on anyone. Jesus consistently gave other people hope. Israel was an oppressed people. Most of the people Jesus taught and interacted with were struggling to survive. So Jesus would look out at the crowds and he'd say things like, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, the peacemakers, the persecuted." He told his followers, if a soldier forces you to carry his luggage 1 mile, carry it 2 miles. Don't just do what's required of you. Shock people with kindness. But also, don't build your identity around being an oppressed person. The first mile, yes, you're being oppressed. But the second mile, you force the soldier to see you, to see your humanity, to make a decision. He can't make you carry his bags a second mile, but he could allow a friend to carry them. You have agency. You can rise above your station by showing generous love to your enemies. Jesus gave people hope, the kind of hope that makes us defiant. Whatever comes your way, abuse, sickness, unemployment, a breakup, these experiences hurt. They're hard. We need to lament them, but they don't define us and they don't destroy us and they don't determine our future. We experience these hardships in the context of Jesus coming and coming again. So we can sing that verse, "The Lord has promised good to me. His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures." Hope energizes us in the present. It keeps us going when things get hard. It keeps us invested in this world, invested in the people around us. We can hold our heads up in the face of insults and injury. Christian hope is not about all our dreams coming true. Christian hope is what steadies us when our worst nightmares come true. Paul says in Romans 5, we glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. One of the great joys of being a pastor is seeing this kind of thing get played out in people's lives. Seeing widows and widowers, cancer patients, the incarcerated, people struggling to have children, people struggling with their children, all experience the riches of God's grace as they press into Jesus while they suffer. As they disabuse themselves of the false hopes for an easy designer life and embrace the one who comforts us when we mourn and brings beauty out of ashes. Hope energizes us in the present so that we can remain invested in this world. Every 4 years, half the country says they're going to move to Canada. Half the country says, well, that's the end of America as we know it. It's always overstated. But the danger is not that we'll become pessimistic. There may well be reasons for concern. The danger is that when people lose hope, they become passive. They pull back, they check out. But friends, this is not an option for us. As Christians, our hope does not depend on who wins elections. Our hope is grounded in Jesus, who defeated death and promises to make all things new. A church like ours ought to have a much greater impact on the city of Northampton than the president does. I don't care who's in the Oval Office. He's in Washington. We're here. We're on the ground. We have relationships, opportunities, jobs, institutions to partner with. All of us moving in the same direction, animated by the same hope, mobilized by the same compassion, ought to make a huge difference in our community. When I look around our congregation, I see so many hope-filled lives. I see people whose hope means that suffering makes them compassionate, not bitter. I see people who carry disease in their bodies who are undaunted. One person emailed me this week and said, I just want to make the most of every opportunity while I still can. I see people praying and laboring for unity and for justice and for the church to be a multicultural body. People doing their part to care for creation. I see people who grew up in broken homes, who carry all kinds of childhood trauma, who are determined to break their family cycles, who are determined to give their kids a better life than they had. I see people who have turned their lives upside down to care for loved ones with chronic conditions, who choose every day to be there for the people in their lives in need of care, who experience the constraints of that calling, but also the freedom to love selflessly and extravagantly. I see grandparents pouring out their lives for their grandkids to give them nurture and stability. There are so many lives in this congregation that are inexplicable apart from hope, that are energized daily by the resurrection of Jesus and by his promise to make all things new, lives that are gripped by the truth that our labor in the Lord is not in vain. There's this wonderful scene in The Lord of the Rings where Osgiliath is falling around Sam and Frodo, the two hobbits who are charged with destroying the One Ring. And Sam says to Frodo, "It's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here, but we are. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were, and sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. And when the sun shines, it will shine out all the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you, that meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't, because they were holding on to something." What are we holding on to, Sam? That there's some good in this world, Mr. Frodo, and it's worth fighting for. Amen. Hope energizes us in the present so that we don't give up when things get hard. All right, real quick, the impact of hope. Peter says that Christian hope is provocative. When people begin to see how your hope energizes you, how it moves you to get close to pain, how it makes you generous and gracious, how it gives you a passion for justice, how it keeps you going when others quit, they will eventually want to know, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you cynical? Why aren't you bitter? Why haven't you given up? And Peter says, always be ready to tell people about the ground of your hope. Always be ready to tell others what Jesus has done for you and how he's changed your entire outlook on everything, including suffering. Hope is provocative. In New Hampshire, I had a friend named Laura, and she became a Christian in her 50s. And I asked her once, how did that happen? That's not a typical story. And she said, well, my neighbor got cancer. And I felt so bad for her, and I wanted to help her in any way that I could. And she just had this joy. And here she was suffering, and she had all these appointments and all these treatments and procedures, and it was hell. And in the meantime, she was so focused on everyone else. And she wasn't afraid, and she wasn't bitter, and I had to know why. And she told me about Jesus and what he had done for her, and I said, if he's real, I want to know him too. Hope is provocative. Hope is not a denial that the world is broken. Hope trusts Jesus with the world's brokenness. Hope trusts that Jesus has overcome the world. He's overcome sin and death. Hope trusts that Jesus will use our trials to form us into people who love like he loves. Hope trusts that Jesus will bring good from the future world into this mess. That's what Advent is all about, friends. Jesus came, he will come again, and we live in the in-between. where his two comings shape everything about us, how we experience hardships, suffering, death, how we navigate conflict and difficult people, circumstances beyond our control. And Advent is a time to renew and enlarge our hope.